Good morning. My name is Dan Hovenstein. I've been a lifelong White Sox fan, and I've written 5 books about the team. And we'll talk about Bill Beck this morning. And what I want to start out with is an image for you of Bill Beck when he was owning the Indians. And there's a picture of him standing right outside of Municipal Stadium, surrounded by about 10 beautiful women. And you can feel the charisma of Bill Beck come right off that photo. And you can see that the young, handsome Bill Beck was having a great time. But he looked at women as part of fans, and he wanted to bring more women into Cleveland Stadium. So one of his promotions was that on a Mother's Day, any woman who came to the game with a child would get an orchid. Because not only did he think that women were important, not just men coming to the game, but he wanted to recruit kids, get them right in when they're young so they become fans of the team. So that's where that promotion came from, and like I said, he was really enjoying himself with those beautiful women. Now, skipping off to 1970, a team that could not draw was the 1970 White Sox. They had the worst season in the history of the franchise. They lost 106 games, and they didn't even draw 500,000 for the season. Their opener drew 11,000. I went to several games that year. If they got 10,000, they were lucky. Usually it was under 10,000. And so by the end of the season, beginning of September, Roland Heeman was hired as general manager of the White Sox. And some of his baseball friends told him, don't go there. Don't manage the White. Don't take that job. Because they're not drawing. They don't have any money. They don't have any farm system. You just do something else. Don't take the GM job with the White Sox. But Heeman told me that he, as he put it, he was a young man back then. And he didn't listen to stuff like that. So he took the job. And in 1972, the White Sox won 87 games. And they finished 5.5 games behind the Oakland A's. And they drew 1.3 million, which was the first time they drew 1 million fans since 1966. And of course, that was Dick Allen's MVP year. But Roland Heeman had changed the face of the team, and they actually were a respectable team after losing 106 games. But by 1975, Allen was gone, and the White Sox returned to losing. And in that season, they drew less than 400,000 less than they did in 1974. And I was at one game, and Bill Melton hit a home run. And I'm standing up clapping because now I'm waiting for the monster to go off, Bill Beck's scoreboard. And yeah, it goes off for a little while, and it was a big dud. Instead of raising your getting you excited, you just sat down and think, oh. Why? Because fireworks cost money. And owner John Allen didn't have money. Ed Herman, their catcher, told me that they were supposed to get a shipment of 6 dozen bats at one time, and only 3 dozen came in. And John Allen told his players, we're a little short. Yeah, I guess so. So, by the end of 1975, it was really obvious that John Allen could not own this team anymore. All this illustrates, he just didn't have the funds to manage the club. And it even looked like it was going to go to Seattle. The Seattle people still ticked that Pilots left there after that 1 year in 1969. But then Bill Beck came and purchased the club. His first offer was turned down by the American League. He had to raise more money. But then in December of 1975, the American League reluctantly okay, Bill Beck buying a team. So the first thing he said that he wanted to do, first of all, he noticed that that scoreboard was not, that those explosions were not explosions. So he said he was going to change that, and you're going to get some real fireworks this time, this year. And we were talking about a piece of people before about how the Sox were a great team in the 50s, and Bill Beck decided, well, he wants to bring back those memories of the Go-Go White Sox in the 1950s, and he's going to hire 67-year-old Paul Richards as manager for the 1976 Sox. And it was all like this feel-good type of thing. So on opening day, April 9th, It was a perfect game for Vivek. He had 40,000 come. It was a cool spring day, but a very sunny school day. There was a sweet smell of pot from left center field upper deck. And the White Sox won a 4-0 game. Wilbur worked through a complete game. Everything was working out real well. It's the perfect opening day for the White Sox. But what I get emotional about is Bill Beck was walking down the left field line in the stands, and a bunch of fans circled him, hugged him, and just thanked him for saving the White Sox. And that was one of the most human things I saw that day. So after that, it looked like actually things were going to turn around. The Sox are not leaving the city. They won 9 in a row beginning of May, and it looks like they're just, it was too good to be true. Not leaving, and you actually out good. The trouble was they weren't that good. And as time went on, they were exposed for a team that didn't hit very well, and their outfield defense wasn't so good. So it was somewhere in the middle of summer, Paul Richards goes out to the mound to talk to a pitcher named Bart Johnson. It's about strategy. And Richards suggests, maybe Bart, maybe you should walk the next guy, just pitch around him. And Bart Johnson looks at him, turns slightly, points to his outfield. He says, how do I pitch around them? And so Paul Richards says, young man, you have a point. Went back to the dugout. Just do what you want. By the end of August, the Sox were in last place. And this feel good hire of Paul Richards didn't turn out to be so good. There was an article in the Chicago Sun-Times on August 31st written by a beat reporter named Joe Goddard. And it was talking about Paul Richards, a man of out of touch with his team. A man who only came to the game about maybe 20 minutes before the game started. Wasn't really in touch with anything. And showed a picture of Richards in the corner of the dugout with a warm-up jacket on, looking cold and lonely. And the thing about it was, I think Joe Goddard made a mistake here. Richards was gone from the team at that time for some reason, so there was no comment from Richards. And then Bill Vec got ticked. And so he had a press conference. Richards is back. Bill Vec has a press conference to reply to this article. And he's mad because most of the sources are anonymous. He challenged them to come out. If you want to say something, come out publicly and say it. And he defended his manager. Of course, what Bill Vec knew, that nobody was going to come and admit anything. If they wanted to play for the Sox next year or any other team in 1977, they were going to come out and say, yeah, I read it on my manager. So it was you could say it was an effective defense of his manager, but really the fans looked at the White Sox by that time is that they thought the White Sox gave up, which was maybe an indication of Richards or not. But what happened towards the end of the month, since September came, the Twins came in for a 3-game series. The whole series drew 9,000 fans. And the Sox lost 22-9. A combination of 22-9 for the 3 games. And they lost 15 out of the last 16. End up in last with 97 losses. And most of the many fans felt that team was a bunch of quitters. And I don't think they thought Richards was, but they thought the team was. And so Vec stood up for his manager, the fans looked at that team and said, no, they're quitters. Paul Richards or not. So most of the White Sox fans for the next year, 1977, didn't expect much. And of course, at this time, free agency started coming in. Bill Vec really couldn't afford to buy high-priced free agency players, so he decided to have this little strategy called rent-a-player. And what he started with is first, he traded future Hall of Famer Rich Gossage and lead pitcher Terry Forster to Pittsburgh for Richie Zisk. And then right before the season started, he traded Bucky Dent for Oscar Gamble. He knew he couldn't sign Gossage. He knew he couldn't sign Forrester. He knew he couldn't sign Dent. He also knew he would not be able to sign Zisk and Gamble after the season. And he also signed Eric Soderholm. And Eric Soderholm had missed the 76 season because he had an off-season, off-field injury. He hurt his knee, and he used that whole year to rehab. And so, as the speaker before me was talking about how the White Sox were not hitters, especially in 67 and the years before that, the 1977 team were hitters. It was the first time the Chicago White Sox team had two 30 home run hitters on one season. And the fans, from the very beginning, took to them. And there was a shirt that they sold. They sold a guy with a big cigar on his mouth, big beard, and eight bats in a circle, and holding like that, looking like a machine gun. And underneath it said Southside Hitman. And that's what they became known as. And Eric Soderholm told me, he says, like when Zisk played in Pittsburgh, he says the fans would fall away in Pittsburgh. And he says, when I played in Minnesota, we didn't get that many people out there. He said, but in 77, the fans are close. Kaminsky, that's close. Fans are close to the field. And you can feel the energy in that ballpark. And it was loud. It's about as loud as I've ever heard it there. And he told me, he hit a home run. He's heading towards second base. He could feel it, just feel all that energy and all that emotion coming from the stands. And the White Sox, by the time, July was ending, they were in first place. But as all vet teams or anything connected with vectors, there has to be controversy. The fans were getting so excited, they had what they wanted to do with players to have what they called curtain calls. Player would hit a home run, and he'd have to stand outside the dugout, tip his hat. And some people didn't take that too well. So in a game, last game of the last month of, last game of day of August, they were playing Kansas City in a doubleheader. In the seventh inning of the second game, Hal McCray hit a home run. And he's running around the bases, and he's running slow, and he's tipping his hat, all the way around the bases, fans booing, he don't care. He says, this is, and then he talks to the reporter after the game, he said, these curtain calls are a disgrace. It's a disgrace to baseball. Their White Sox fans are making fools out of their players, having them do that stuff. And he says, if they were in the National League, they'd get a ball in a year. And oh, by the way, we're a lot better than the White Sox, and we're gonna pass them up like they're standstill. Which happened. The A's went on to win 102 games, and the White Sox, even though they had a very exciting season, finished 12 games behind the Royals. But this was the first time they won 90 games since 1965. And they also had a big 26 games improvement over the previous year. And they also set a record for attendance at that time. And the last game of the season, a meaningless game in Seattle, after the game was over, the fans did not want to leave the field. So Vec said, let them stay there. He just kept the park open until they all left, because they wanted that connection to the Southside. But unfortunately, of course, during the season, even if things were going well, there were stories in the papers, Oscar Gamble was going to leave, Richie Zisk was going to leave, and that team is really kind of being dismantled. And Gamble told me he wanted to stay. He said, but the offer from Beck did not come close to what the Padres were offering, so he went to San Diego. So this sets up what no White Sox fan wants to talk about, and that's Disco Demolition. Because by 2 years later, the White Sox are still losing, attendance is going down. If White Sox fans are seeing all these high-placed players going everywhere else but not Chicago. And so they knew, you know, the details of what happened that night. And what the White Sox did not realize is they got in the middle of a culture war. Those fans, of course, came there were not fans. They had no interest in the White Sox or baseball. The Bee Gees, who had their great success with their Saturday Night Live soundtrack, were performing on the West Coast, and they've already had death threats. And then they found out about Disco Demolition, and they were devastated by that. And they made up their mind after that that they would not have anything to do with disco music. And that's what the Sox got caught up in. That, like I said, those people are not fans. I'll give you an image to think about. I went to a game in June of 1974. There was a fire in the concession stands, and smoke came over to the lower right field stands, thick smoke. The fans had to leave and go on the field just to get away from the smoke. And then it took an hour for this to clear up. So it all finally cleared up. The fans came back, went back to their seats. There was not one hot dog wrapper on the ground. There was not one crumpled beer cup, nothing. This field was pristine. Those were White Sox fans. And I don't think that, like I said, I don't think that the Vex understood what they got themselves into. Because that was violence. So like I said, the Bee Gees were really freaked out about this. And they just quit doing disco music. So I want to read you five names though, and as I wrap this up a little bit. Lamar Hoyt, Richard Dotson, Harold Baines, Ron Kittle, Britt Burns. All those guys came to the White Sox when Beck owned the team in the late 70s. All those five guys were the core of the 1983 division winners who won 99 games. Now, Reinsdorf and Einhorn had to add a lot of people to that team, but the core of the people, of the players, were brought there by Bill Beck. And that was the first division title for either Chicago team since divisional play started in 1969. And it was the first Chicago baseball team to draw 2 million fans in a season. And I'll leave you one other story about Bill Beck, and it was told by Bill Gleason, the columnist for the Sun-Times. He's being interviewed right here in Miller's Pub. And he says, one night, I'm sitting with Bill Beck, and we're drinking all night long. Just all night long. And he says, I couldn't believe it. He never had to go to the bathroom. And then he said, excuse me, I have to go to the bathroom. Thank you. Any questions?
Well done, Dan. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
You mentioned five players right towards the end of the lecture. Three of those five came from other organizations, Hoyt from the Yankees, Dotson from the Angels, and Kittle from the Dodgers. How effective was the scouting department of the White Sox under Beck?
Obviously it was somewhat good. Kittle, what Kittle did is he came to the Comiskey Park in the late 70s and just went in the cage and hit a bunch of home runs on the upper deck and Beck signed him. I don't know about the other two. Beck was very proud of drafting Harold Baines, though.
If I remember correctly, he said 1976 was the year that the White Sox wore shorts for part of the season.
Yeah, they did.
Did you see anything about that?
All I remember about that is the John Mayberry of the Royals says, you're the cutest team I've ever seen.
Dan, I thought you'd be out here modeling those shorts.
Yeah.
the one thing you jumped over was actually the rent-a-player thing was interesting because Vec tried to bring, the concept was I'm going to get these guys who are going to be eligible for free agency in a year because they're going to want to have a real good year and then I can move them and I'll do something so the following year. You know, 1978 was kind of the Barry Bonds years for the Sox, and that just, I mean, I don't I know you didn't talk about it, but I'm kind of interested in just, like, that would be an interesting topic for study, because I think people do use that at times. Like, that is a tool that Vec kind of invented that I think over the course of years, other people have employed, not to, like, rebuild the whole team, but to take advantage of.
Well,
and Barry Bonds just didn't work. I mean, not Barry, Bobby Bonds just didn't, you know. But
yeah,
they tried it again.
You have a point there, yeah, and there is a strategy to it. But if you look at it, he trades Gossage, he loses Gossage. He loses Forster, he ends up losing Zis. He trades Dent, he ends up losing him, then he ends up losing Gamble. You lost seven players there. So, you know, there's a logic to it, but then there's a backside to it.
Yeah. Maxwell was talking about the scouting. I think, wasn't Britt Burns discovered by Bob Cromie?
I really don't know.
Yeah. I've heard that story.
I just know by 1980, he looked like he was going to be one of the greatest left-handers ever.
Yeah.
And by 1985 or 86, he's out of baseball because he had so many physical problems. He was, when he came up in 1980, he was one hell of a pitcher. I know that much.
Now, Bill Deck was known for a lot of fun promotions and, like, Disco Demolition Night, which was, you know, kind of a disaster. I was wondering, as a fan back then, if you went to any games where you, like, saw anything, like, fun that Bill Deck had, or any fun promotions that were a success, not like Disco Demolition?
Not that I can remember, but I can tell you this. There was a feeling of fun around the ballpark. You know, I was at a game where Chet Lemon hit a routine fly ball to left field, and Tom Green was playing for the Rangers, and he's coming in to get it, and it was foggy. And he looks up, he can't find it. And he all goes like this. And the ball, and it rained the day before, so the ball came out and dropped right in the middle of left field. And he still didn't see it. And by the time he did, Lemon had a 3 RBI triple. And the fans behind me said they were imagining Bill Deck on the roof with a fan blowing the fog over the stadium. And that's how people looked at him. And this sorts of thing, you know, people can laugh at that and have a good time with it. And most of the time, it was fun. But I think you can see the genius of him when he gave the orchids to the women. That is something there, and that helps create good feelings, and that is successful marketing. Well, okay, thanks a lot.